Chapter 33. The Wager. My heart pounded. I could not bring myself to step onto the rug with Damnu.
"Come, my pet, I don't have all day,"
she smirked, baring her uneven teeth.
"Neither do you."
"Don't go near her,"
whispered Shim frantically.
"I am waiting," growled Damnu.
Perspiration beaded on my brow. What was I to do? Maybe if I humored her, I could still find some way to win her help. Yet no sooner had I formed this thought than I knew it was impossible. Damnu would never send us to the castle, for she believed that to do so would guarantee that we would lose our lives and she her wager. And, I admitted grimly to myself, she was probably right. Even so, dragging a whimpering Shim with me, I moved toward the edge of the rug. I had no idea what to do next, either about Damnu's game or my own quest to help Rhea. I only knew that we had traveled too far, survived too much, to give up before trying every possibility. When I reached the edge of the rug, Damnu pointed to the black horse weighed down by the stone.
"Make your move," she commanded.
But, I stammered, "I don't know the rules."
"That has not stopped you before, I'll wager."
Unsure of her meaning, I tried again. "Can you tell me the rules?"
"The way I play, you can make up your own rules, until you break one of mine, that is."
I faltered. "I don't know how to begin."
"In the game of chess, unlike the game of life, you get to choose how you begin."
"But what if I choose poorly?"
"Ah," she said, wrinkling her scalp. "In that way, the two games are quite alike. One way or another, your choice will make all the difference."
Drawing a deep breath, I stepped onto the rug of red and black squares. Hesitantly, I laid down my staff. Then, with effort, I lifted the black stallion and carried it all the way over to the other side of the rug. I placed it on a square directly in front of the red king.
Observed Damnu. "You chose a very risky move, my pet."
She eyed me curiously.
"Though no more risky than storming the shrouded castle without an army."
She shoved the Red King to a square where he could hide behind a pair of goblins.
"You must have some sort of reason."
"I do. It is
a terrible shame you are so eager to die. Especially when you are just learning how to play the game. Normally, I would be quite happy to help you die sooner, but a wager is a wager."
"What if I made you a wager myself?" Damnu scratched her hairless head.
"What kind of wager?"
"Well," I replied, my mind racing, "if you can get me to the castle..."
"Us,"
corrected Shim. Although his whole body was quaking, he let go of my leg and stood on his own beside me.
"We goes together. I is still feeling the same old madness."
I nodded at him, then turned back to Damnu.
"If you can get us to the castle, then I will wager you that we will still survive this day, even with Stangmar and all his goblins and ghoulians there to greet us. You could wager the opposite, that we won't succeed."
Damnu pulled thoughtfully on one of her ears.
"Ah, so you are raising the stakes, are you?"
"That's right."
"And what happens if you don't survive the day?"
"Well, then you would have lost one wager against Rita Gower, but you will have won another against me. So at the end of the day, you will be no worse off, whereas if you don't wager me, you will finish the day merely having lost."
She frowned.
"Not a chance. What sort of a novice wagerer do you take me for, boy? I am giving you something of value by sending you to the castle. Whether or not you win, you get that much. And what do I get? Nothing."
My face fell.
"But I have nothing to give you."
"Too bad." Her head wrinkled. "Time for your next move."
"Wait."
I pulled out the dagger from Hone.
"You could take this?"
Damnu frowned again, waving it away.
"A weapon? Why would I ever need that?"
"Then what about this?"
I removed the satchel that Branwen had given to me.
"These herbs are good for healing."
Damnu hissed.
"What use would I have for such a thing?"
As I picked up my staff, she declared, "I have no need of that, either." I knew well that my one truly valuable possession was the Galator. I suspected that Domnoon knew it also. Yet if I parted with that, my quest would be ruined.
"Here," said Shim, starting to peel off his baggy shirt of woven bark. "You can keep this, made by my own mother when I is a babesy."
He sighed.
"A shame I never outgrows it."
Domnoon scowled.
"Keep it yourself."
The black eyes probed me.
"If you have nothing more to offer, then we have nothing more to discuss, except, of course, the game of chess."
My head was whirling. While I knew almost nothing about the Galator's powers, they were clearly extraordinary. Vast beyond knowing, Carepray had said. I could not possibly part with this, the last treasure. It had already saved our lives once. It might well do so again. Besides, if Stangmar wanted it so badly, I might somehow be able to use it to bargain for Rhea's life. Though I had no way of knowing if she was still alive, I could be sure that without the Galator, I could never save her. Moreover, this jeweled pendant had been worn by my own mother. She had given it to me to keep, to protect. To give it away would also be to give away some of her love for me. And yet, if I did not offer it to Domnoon, she would never help me, and I could not possibly reach the castle without her help. So I, in turn, could not help Rhea. Then again, what good was it to reach the castle without the Galator?
"Your move," she nudged me impatiently. "Make your move."
"All right, I will." Slowly, I removed the Galator from my neck. "You know this pendant, don't you?"
Domnoon yawned, showing all her unruly teeth.
"I have seen it a few times over the ages, yes. What about it?"
"Then you also know its value." The hag remained dispassionate.
"I have heard rumors."
Shim tugged hard on my tunic.
"Don't do this. This is foolishly."
Ignoring him, I declared, "I will wager you with the Galator. If you can get us to the castle of Stangmar, I will..." I choked on the words. "I will give it to you."
The black eyes swelled.
"No!" cried Shim. "We needs it!"
I took a step toward her.
"But if either Shim or I should ever return to you alive, no matter how much time has passed, then you must give the Galator back."
Grasping the leather cord, I held up the pendant. Its jewels gleamed darkly in the shifting light.
"Those are the terms of my wager."
Domnoon clucked as if she were about to swallow something tasty.
"And if you should ever return, which I doubt, my pet, you would trust me to give it back to you?"
"No,"
protested Shim. I regarded her sternly.
"You said you never break the rules."
"That is true."
Then she added in passing,
"With minor exceptions here and there, of course."
All of a sudden, her hand shot out and snatched the pendant.
"You have a wager."
My heart sank. The Galator was gone. Domnoon gazed briefly into the Galator, her eyes reflecting its green hue. She plunged it into one of the sagging pockets in her robe. Then she smiled the smile of someone who has just won a grand wager. For my part, I felt sure that I had just given away my last best hope.
"You wanted that all the time," I said bitterly.
"I suppose that is true, my pet."
"Why didn't you just take it from me, then? Why did you drag it out like this?"
Domnoon looked offended.
"Me? Take something that does not belong to me? Never."
She patted the pocket with the Galator.
"Besides, the Galator must be given freely, not stolen, or else its powers are useless. Did no one ever tell you that?"
I shook my head.
"Too bad."
She released an extended yawn.
"Definitely too bad."
"Let's get on with your part," I said grimly. "How are you going to get us to the castle?"
"You wouldn't mind a slight delay, would you?"
she asked.
"I am feeling quite tired at the moment."
"Delay?"
"Yes."
She yawned again.
"Just until tomorrow sometime."
"No, you promised."
"That's dishonestly."
She scrutinized us for a moment.
Well, all right. I suppose I can get you there today, but you should be ashamed for denying a poor old woman her much-needed rest.
Her bald head wrinkled in thought.
The only question is how to do it.
She patted the top of her head, her dark eyes roaming around the room.
Ah, that's it. Wings. You will need wings, perhaps even a pair you are accustomed to.
My heart leaped as I wondered whether she might be referring to the legendary wings that Caerprey had told me about. Was Domnu about to restore to me what all Finchirans had lost long ago? I flexed my shoulders in anticipation.
Her feet slapped across the floor to the doorway. She opened the heavy door, reached into the darkness, and pulled out a compact iron cage. It contained a small, tattered hawk.
A merlin! Trouble!
I rushed at the cage. The bird flapped and whistled enthusiastically, ripping at the iron bars with his talons.
Let him out!
I pleaded, my fingers stroking the warm feathers through the bars.
Careful! Warned Domnu. He is feisty, this one. A real fighter. Small in body, large in spirit. He could rip you to shreds if he chose.
Not me, he won't.
She shrugged.
If you insist.
She tapped the cage lightly, and it instantly disappeared. Trouble found himself falling, but caught himself just before he hit the floor. With two flaps and a whistle, he landed on the top of my staff, before hopping down to my left shoulder. With his feathered neck, he nuzzled my ear. Then he turned to Domnu and raked the air angrily with his talons.
"How did you find him?"
I asked. She scratched the wart on her forehead.
"He found me, though I have no idea how. He looked, well, rather feeble when he arrived, like someone had tried to make him into mincemeat. How the little wretch could fly at all is a miracle. I fixed him up a bit, hoping I might be able to teach him to play dice. But the ungrateful savage refused to cooperate.
At this, Trouble whistled sharply and clawed the air again.
Yes, yes, I threw him in the cage against his will, but it was for his own good.
Trouble whistled another reprimand.
And for my own protection. When I told him I had no interest in finding his friend, he flew at me, tried to attack me. I could have turned him into a worm right then and there. But I decided to keep him around in case his manners improved. At any rate, he should prove useful to us now.
Puzzled, Trouble and I cocked our heads in unison.
I should warn you, Domnu continued, that while I can get you to the castle, I cannot get you into the castle. That much you will have to do on your own. Not to mention getting out again.
She peeked inside the pocket holding the Galator.
Since I will not be seeing you again, allow me to thank you for giving me this.
I sighed, but the familiar weight on my shoulder tempered my sadness. I indicated the bird.
And thank you for giving me this.
Domnu slid toward us. As Trouble eyed her warily, she placed her hands on both my head and Shim's. With the same look of concentration she had shown when shrinking the chess pieces, she started muttering. All at once, I felt myself growing smaller. Beyond Shim's shriek, I heard Domnu calling some sort of instructions to Trouble. In a flash, the hawk was no longer riding on my shoulder. Instead, it was I who was riding on Trouble's feathery shoulder, flying high above the dark hills. Chapter 34. Flight. Flying through the darkness, I wrapped my arms tightly around Trouble's neck. By the angle of the bird's back, I could tell that we were steadily gaining altitude. In one hand, I held my staff, now almost as small as myself. I wondered where Shim might be at this moment, hoping that he was at least safe. Chilled air flowed over us so strongly that my sightless eyes began to water, sending thin streams of tears across my cheeks and over my ears. Neck feathers quivered with every gust, brushing against my face and hands. Being no larger than Trouble's own head, I realized that the hawk's feathers were much more than the soft, fluffy plumage they had once seemed. Each quill combined the flexibility of a branch with the sturdiness of a bone. Gradually, the motions of the body bearing me became my own.
With every upstroke of the powerful wings, I inhaled. With every downstroke, I exhaled. I could feel Trouble's shoulder and back muscles tense before each beat, then spring into action with startling strength. As we flew, I listened with all my concentration to hear whatever I could in the blackness. I felt surprised to realize how little sound the beating wings themselves made. Only a quiet whoosh of air accompanied every downstroke, the barest creak of shoulder bones, every upstroke. For the first time in my life, I tasted the freedom of flight. The surrounding darkness only enhanced my sensation of soaring without limits, without boundaries. Wind in my face, I caught at least a hint of the sublime experience that the people of Finkaida had once known, then lost. An experience that I recalled not in my mind, but in my bones. The wind shifted, and I heard a faint whimpering coming from below the talons. I realized that Trouble was also carrying another passenger, just as on a different day the hawk might carry a field mouse. And I knew that Shim, now littler than little, must be just as distraught as a mouse about to be eaten. I tried to stretch my second sight to the limit and beyond, to push back the darkness that seemed to thicken as we progressed. Yet I felt the limits of my vision more than its gifts. The castle's shroud poured over the dark hills. It enveloped them just as it did the three of us. For we were flying into the land, as Rhea had once put it, where the night never ends. With effort, I sensed some of the contours of the hills rising below. No trees dotted this terrain, no rivers creased its slopes. At one point, I felt the land fall away into a steep but narrow canyon, and I heard the faint cry of what might have been an eagle. To the north, a dense group of flaming torches mingled with the raspy shouts of goblins, and to the south, eerie lights flickered that chilled me deeper than the wind. On the slopes above the canyon, I detected a few clusters of buildings, which once had been villages. A strange, uncertain yearning arose in me. Might I, as a young child, have lived in one of those villages? If I could somehow view this land in the light, would it bring back at least a little of my lost memory? But the villages below were as dark and silent as my own childhood. No fires burned in any hearths, no voices lifted in any squares. I doubted that any laborers like Hone still toiled away in this terrain as their ancestors had for centuries before the rise of Stangmar and the onset of never-ending darkness. It was even less likely that any gardeners could have survived in such a place, for the land of Taelin and Garlatha at least still clung to twilight, while the lands below existed in permanent eclipse. The darkness deepened, pressing against us like a heavy blanket. I felt Trouble's rapid heartbeat pulsing through the veins of the bird's neck. At the same time, the beating of the wings slowed down just a notch, as if the darkness inhibited flight in the same way that it inhibited vision. The Merlin leveled off. More and more, his wings faltered, sometimes not completing a stroke, other times missing a stroke entirely. As the cold winds gusted, he weaved unsteadily. His head cocked to one side and then the other. He seemed confused, trying to see what could not be seen. He struggled to stay on course. I clutched my feathered steed. If Trouble was having such difficulty seeing, how could he possibly guide us safely into the ever-spinning castle? Perhaps that was the point of Damnu's final warning, that getting near the castle would be less difficult than getting inside it. With a slap of fear, I realized that our only hope now lay in my own second sight. I, whose own eyes were blind, must somehow see for the hawk. Although my second sight had always grown weaker as the light around me faded, I could not let that happen this time. Perhaps second sight did not require light after all. Perhaps I could see despite the dark. I summoned all of my energy. I must try to pierce the darkness. Minutes passed. I could sense nothing different. And why should I? I had never before been able to see at night, even when my eyes functioned. What made me think I could change that now? Yet I continued to try to probe with my mind's eye, to see beyond the grays, beyond the shadows, to fill in the swaths of darkness, just as Rhea showed me how to fill in the empty places between the stars.
Meanwhile, Trouble's flight grew more erratic and uneven. His wings labored as the fierce winds buffeted us. The bird hesitated, changed direction, hesitated again. So very gradually that I myself did not at first notice the shift, I began to sense wispy images through the thickening darkness, a curve in a ridge, a depression that might once have been a lake, a twisting road, an uneven line that could only be a wall of stone. Then, in the deep distance, I detected something odd, a vague throbbing glimmer on a far ridge. It seemed both moving and stationary, both light and dark. I was not even certain that it really existed. Firmly, sinking my arms deep into his feathery neck, I turned Trouble's head toward the spot. The bird resisted at first, then started to shift the angle of his wings. Slowly, he changed direction. In time, I detected a structure of some kind, mammoth in size. It rose from a high hill like a black ghost of the night. I thought I could see strange rings of light on its sides and some sort of pinnacles at its top. As foreboding as Damnu's lair had felt, this structure felt 100 times worse. Still, pushing firmly on Trouble's neck, I guided us closer. By now, Trouble not only accepted my steering, but also seemed heartened by it. The wings beat with renewed strength. I reached farther and farther with my second sight. Now I could see the flat hilltop, scattered with stones where the strange structure sat. Yet even as the land surrounding it became clearer, the structure itself remained blurred. A low rumbling sound swelled as we approached, a sound like stone grinding against stone. At once I understood. The structure was slowly turning on its foundation. We had found the shrouded castle. Biting my lip in concentration, I steered the hawk to fly in a circle around the revolving castle. The blurred outlines immediately sharpened. The pinnacles revealed themselves as towers, the rings of light as torches seen through the spinning windows and archways. Every so often, within the torch-lit rooms, I glimpsed soldiers wearing the same pointed helmets as the warrior goblins. I focused my vision on one lower window where no soldiers seemed to be present. Then I guided Trouble into a dive. We aimed straight at the window. The battlements, the towers, the archways drew near. Suddenly, I realized that we were flying too slow, dropping too far. We were going to hit the wall. Across my mind flashed the terrifying dream I had experienced at sea. I pulled with all my might, forcing the hawk to veer sharply upward. Shim, clasped in the talons, screamed. We whizzed past the battlements, barely above the stones. In another split second, we would have crashed. Refocusing, I brought Trouble around again. This time, as we circled the castle, I tried to gauge our relative speeds more closely. Yet I faltered. The truth was, I had no eyes, no real vision. Did I dare try again, guided only by my second sight? I sucked in my breath, then urged the hawk into another dive. We shot down toward the same open window as before. Wind tore at me, screaming in my ears. As the window neared, my stomach tightened like a fist. Even the slightest error would send us smashing into the wall. Our speed accelerated. We could not turn back now. We tore through the window. In the same instant, I saw a stone column straight ahead. Leaning hard, I caused Trouble to swing left. We brushed past the column, slid across the floor, and slammed into a wall somewhere in the bowels of the shrouded castle. Chapter 35, The Shrouded Castle. When I regained consciousness, the first thing I noticed was how small Trouble had become. The valiant bird sat on top of my chest, poking at me with one wing and then the other. At once, I realized the truth. It was I, not the bird, who had changed size. I had grown large again. Seeing me wake up, the Merlin hopped down to the stone floor. He released a low, quiet whistle, much like a sigh of relief. A similar sound came from the far corner of the bare, shadowy room, beneath a sputtering torch, fixed to the wall with a black iron stand. Shim sat up, looked at Trouble, patted himself from hairy head to hairy toes, blinked, and patted himself again.
The little giant turned to me, his nose cradled by a bright smile.
I is gladly to be big and tall again.
I raised an eyebrow, but kept myself from smirking.
Yes, we are both big again. Domnu must have worked her magic so that it would wear off if we entered the castle.
Shim scowled.
How kindly of her!
I am grateful to her for that much.
I reached to stroke the hawk's banded wings.
And more.
Trouble gave a resolute chirp. The yellow rims of his eyes shone in the torchlight. He scratched his talons on the stone floor, telling me that once again he was ready for battle. Yet the hawk's feistiness buoyed my spirits for only an instant. I scanned the rough, imposing stone surrounding us. The walls, floor, and ceiling of this room showed no adornment, no craftsmanship whatsoever. The shrouded castle had been built not out of love, but out of fear. If there had been any love at all during its construction, it was merely the love of cold stone and sturdy defenses. As a result, unless this room was an exception, the castle would hold no beauty, no wonder, but it would, in all likelihood, outlast the dark hills themselves. I felt sure it would outlast me. Only then did I notice the continuous rumbling around us. The rumbling swelled, faded, and repeated, as incessantly as ocean waves. The sound of the castle turning on its foundation. As I clambered to my feet, I felt thrown off balance, both by the continuous shaking of the floor and the steady pull toward the outside wall of the room. I stooped to pick up my staff. Even with its support, I needed a moment to stand firmly. I turned to Shim. I would feel a lot better if I still had the Galator.
Look,
he replied, standing on his tiptoes by the open window.
It's all so darkly out there, and feels the floor moving and shaking all the time. I doesn't like this place.
Neither do I.
I is scared. Very, very, very scared.
I am too. I nodded in his direction. But it gives me courage to be with friends.
A new gleam appeared in Shim's tiny eyes.
Courage, he said softly to himself. I gives him courage.
Come.
Carefully, I crept to the doorway. It led to a dark corridor, lit only by a hissing torch at the far end.
We must try to find Rhea. If she is alive, she is probably below in the dungeon.
Shim's small chest inflated.
Such a terribly place. I will fight anybody who is hurting her.
No, you won't.
I countered.
The castle is guarded by warrior goblins and ghoulians.
Ooh!
He swiftly deflated.
We should not fight them.
Right. We must outfox them if we can, not fight them.
Trouble fluttered up to my shoulder, and we set off. Down the dimly lit corridor we stole, keeping as quiet as possible. Fortunately, the steady rumbling of the revolving castle covered most of our sounds, but for the slightest clacking of my staff against the stones. I reasoned that as long as we could keep ourselves from being discovered, the castle guards were probably not alert for intruders. On the other hand, I vividly recalled expecting the same thing of the goblins patrolling the notch near the haunted marsh. When we reached the hissing torch, crudely jammed into a niche in the stones, the corridor turned sharply to the right. Arched doorways lined both sides of the next section, while only one narrow window slit opened to the outside. As we approached the window, I tensed as I saw shafts of darkness streaming through it, as shafts of light would pour through a window in any land not choked by the shroud. Gingerly, I placed my hand in the path of one of the shafts. Its coldness nipped at my fingers. My skin felt withered. Half alive. With a shiver, I withdrew my hand and moved on. Shim's bare feet padded softly by my side as Trouble's talons hugged my shoulder securely. One corridor led to another, one sputtering torch to the next. All the rooms that we encountered were empty except for the writhing shadows of torchlight. I could only imagine how many such empty floors lay within this vast castle. Yet, for all our wandering, we did not discover any stairs. Cautiously we prowled the maze of corridors, turning left, then right, right, then left. I began to wonder whether we were traveling in circles, whether we would ever find any stairs to the lower levels. Then, as we approached one doorway, trouble fluttered against my neck. Suddenly, I heard several raspy voices trading rough remarks. Goblins, several of them from the sound of it. We waited outside the arched door, unsure how to get past without being seen. Trouble paced agitatedly on my shoulder. Then an idea struck me. I tapped the Merlin on the beak while pointing inside the doorway. The hawk seemed to understand instantly. Soundlessly, he floated down to the floor. Keeping to the shadows by the wall, he slipped into the room. Just outside the doorway, Shim and I traded nervous glances. A few seconds later, one of the goblins yelped in pain.
"You stabbed me, you fool!"
"I did not," another retorted over the crash of something metallic. "Liar!"
Something heavy thudded against the stone floor. A sword slashed through the air.
"I'll show you who's a liar!"
A brawl began. Swords clanged, fists struck, curses flew. In the commotion, Shim and I sneaked past the doorway. Pausing only long enough for Trouble to swoop back to his perch on my shoulder, we scuttled down the corridor. As we turned a corner, we found ourselves facing a stairwell. Faintly lit by a flickering torch on the landing, the stone stairs wound downward in near darkness. I led the way with Trouble riding close to my cheek, both of us trying to sense whatever might lurk in the shadows. Shim, whispering nervously to himself, stayed close behind. The stairs spiraled down to another landing, sinister in the torchlight. Swaying shadows crawled across the walls. As we descended, the rumbling and groaning of the turning foundation increased, as did the stale odor in the air. We followed the stairs down to another level, gloomier than the last, and to another level, still gloomier. Here the stairs ended, opening into a high stone archway. Beyond that lay a dark cellar that reeked of putrid air.
"The dungeon,"
I whispered above the constant rumbling. Shim made no reply except to open his eyes to their widest. From the darkened entrance to the dungeon came a long, painful moan, a moan of sheer agony. The voice sounded almost human, though not quite. As the moan came again, louder than before, Shim froze as stiff as stone. Cautiously, I moved forward without him, poking at the blackest shadows with my staff. Passing under the archway, I peered into the dungeon. To the left, beneath one of the few torches in the cavernous room, I viewed a man. He lay on his back on a bench of stone. From his slow, regular breathing, he appeared to be asleep. Although a sword and a dagger hung from his belt, he wore no armor, except for a narrow red breastplate over his leather shirt and a pointed helmet on his head. Yet the strangest thing about this man was his face. It looked like paper, it was so pale, or like a mask without any expression. Whatever the reason, the face seemed alive, and yet not alive. The man suddenly started moaning and wailing. As the sound echoed in the dungeon, I realized that he must be dreaming, recalling in his sleep some moment of pain. Though I felt tempted to wake him to spare him such torment, I dared not take the risk. As I spun around to tell Shim, I gasped. The little giant was gone. Quickly, I darted back to the stairwell. I called his name, loud enough to be heard over the rumbling of the castle, but not so loud as to wake the sleeping soldier. Looking frantically, I could see no sign of him. I called again, no answer. How could Shim have vanished? Where could he have gone? Maybe he had at last lost his nerve completely. He might be hiding somewhere, quaking. In any case, I had no time to look for him now. With Trouble riding tensely on my shoulder, I turned around and crept past the sleeping soldier under the sizzling torch. Deeper into the dungeon I pushed. Where chains hung from the walls, the stones beneath were darkened with dried blood. I passed cell after cell, some with their heavy doors wide open, some still locked tight. Scanning through the slit in each of the locked doors, I found bones and rotting flesh. still on the floor. I could not imagine Rhea, with all her zest for life, imprisoned in such a gruesome place. Yet, given the alternative, I desperately hoped that she was. Since the day the sea returned me to Finkaira, I had discovered a little, but only a little, about my past, and I had learned even less about my true name. Yet those unfinished quests now pulled on me far less strongly than my desire to find Rhea. I was willing to put aside my own unanswered questions, perhaps forever, if only I could somehow reach her in time. I found a cell with a skull crushed beneath a heavy rock, then one in which two skeletons, one the size of an adult and the other no bigger than a baby, embraced each other for eternity. Then one that was completely empty but for the pile of leaves in one corner. More despairing with every step, I trudged on. Had I come all this way to find nothing more than scattered bones and a pile of leaves? I halted. A pile of leaves! I sprinted back to the cell, my heart pounding. I peered again into the narrow slit. Just loud enough to be heard above the rumbling, I made the sound that Rhea had shown me to make a beech tree come to life. The pile of leaves stirred. "Rhea?" I whispered excitedly.
"Emrys?"
She leaped to her feet and bounded to the door. Her garb of vines was tattered and filthy, but she was alive.
"Oh, Emrys," she said in disbelief. "Is it you or your ghost?"
In answer, I slipped my forefinger through the slit. Tentatively, she wrapped her own around it as she had so many times before.
"It is you."
"It is."
"Let me out. First, I must find the key."
Rhea's face fell.
"The guard, by the entrance, he has the key."
She squeezed my finger fearfully.
"But he is a soundly sleeper,"
finished another voice. I whirled around to see Shim gazing up at me, an unmistakable look of pride on his small face. The little giant held out his hand. In it sat a large key wrought of iron. I stared at him in amazement.
"You stole this from the guard?"
Shim blushed, his bulbous nose turning almost as pink as his eyes.
"He is a soundly sleeper, so it isn't hard."
Trouble, seated on my shoulder, whistled in admiration. I grinned. It struck me that Shim might not be so small as he seemed after all. With a rattle of the key, I unlocked the door. Rhea emerged, her face haggard but relieved. She embraced me, Trouble, and finally Shim, whose nose blushed more vividly than before. Turning to me, she asked,
"How do we get out of here?"
"I haven't figured out that part yet."
"Well then, let's begin."
"I only wish I still had the Galator."
Rhea's jaw dropped.
"You lost it?"
"I gave it up to get here."
Even in the dungeon, her eyes glowed. She hooked her finger around my own again.
"You still have us."
Together we started walking toward the entrance. Trouble fluttered against my neck. Even without the Galator against my chest, my heart felt a bit warmer. But only a bit. As we passed the cell with the crushed skull, I told Rhea,
"Getting in here was difficult, but getting out will be even more difficult. That is, getting out alive."
"I know."
She stood as straight as a young beech.
"In that case, all we can do is hope that Arbasa was right."
Trouble, who had started to pace across my shoulder, stopped. He cocked his head as if he were listening.
"About meeting again in the other world?"
Rhea gave an uncertain nod.
"After the long journey."
I could only frown. I was sure that if we died today, there would be no more journeys for us, long or short. Shim tugged on my tunic.
"Let's get going, before that snoringly guard wakes."
Suddenly the soldier stepped out of the shadows. His face, deathly pale under his helmet, showed no expression at all. Slowly he slid his sword out of its scabbard. Then he lunged at me. Chapter 36. The Last Treasure.
"Look out!" cried Rhea.
I threw up my staff, deflecting the blow with its gnarled top. As chips of wood flew, I pulled out my dagger. At the same time, the soldier drew back his sword. He prepared to make another thrust. Screeching, talons gouging, trouble flew straight into his face. One talon slashed his cheek. Without even a cry of pain, he swatted at the attacking bird. I seized the moment to bury my dagger deep in the soldier's chest, just below the breastplate. I stepped back, expecting to see him fall. Trouble flitted back to his customary perch on my shoulder. Astonishingly, the soldier merely stood there, his emotionless gaze fixed on the hilt of the dagger. Dropping his sword, which clattered on the stone floor, he grasped the dagger with both hands. With a sharp tug, he pulled it from his body and cast it aside. Not so much as a single drop of blood trickled from the wound. Before he could retrieve his sword, Rhea grabbed me by the arm. "Flee," she cried. "He is a Gulliant. He cannot die." We dashed through the dungeon's entrance and ran up the stairs. Not far behind, the deathless soldier bounded after us. Rhea led the way, trailing torn vines from her leggings, followed closely by me and Shim. Up the spiraling stairs we raced, nearly tripping over the stone steps in our frenzy, past the next landing with its sputtering torch, and the next, and the next. The stairwell grew narrower as we climbed higher. Rhea, her legs as strong as ever, pulled farther ahead of me, while Shim fell farther behind. Panting, I glanced over my shoulder. The Gulliant had drawn within a few steps of him. Seeing Shim's danger, Trouble took off, his wings slapping the side of my neck. His angry screech echoed in the stairwell as he flew again into the face of our pursuer. The Gulliant fell back a few steps, trying to fight off the bird. As they battled, so did their shadows on the dimly lit stone walls. I hesitated. Should I follow Rhea or go back to assist Trouble? I heard a scream from up the stairwell. "Rhea!" I practically flew up the stairs, taking them two at a time. The stairwell curled tighter and tighter, narrowing almost to a point. Breathing hard, I rounded a bend and arrived at a landing much larger and better lit than the lower ones. At once, I stopped. Before me spread an enormous hall, its walls lined with flaming torches and glittering objects, its ceiling vaulting high overhead. But my attention was fixed on the center of the hall. Rhea had been captured by a warrior goblin. His tongue flitting around his gray-green lips, the goblin had pinned her arms behind her back. His burly hand covered her mouth so that she could not cry out again. "Welcome to our castle," thundered a powerful voice. I swung around to see a large man, his face as stern as chiseled stone, seated upon a red throne that shimmered eerily. His mouth seemed etched in a permanent frown. Grim though he was, he looked darkly handsome as well. Beneath the gold circlet he wore on his brow, his black eyes glared intensely. Over his face and body wavered some strange shadows, although I could not tell what caused them. Gathered around Stangmar's throne stood five or six Gulliants, their faces as hollow as corpses. Two Finkairan men stood among them, their coal-black hair brushing against the shoulders of their red robes. One of the men stood tall and thin like a great insect, while the other was built like the stump of a thick tree. Recalling what Caer Pray had told me, I scanned closely the faces of the two men, wondering if one of them might actually be my own father. Yet as much as I had once longed to find my father, I now dreaded the prospect, for I could only despise a man who would serve a king as wicked as Stangmar. "I just want to know him," I had said to Branwyn at our last conversation. "It is better you do not," she had replied. Alas, if he had fallen to the state of the group before me, I now understood why. Rhea, seeing me, struggled ferociously to free herself. The warrior goblin merely wheezed in laughter and held her more tightly. "We suspected you would come here eventually," declared Stangmar with his fixed frown, "especially with your friend here to bait the trap." I started, wondering why he should care where I was. Then I realized that Stangmar still believed that I wore the Galator, the last treasure he had long been seeking. How I could take advantage of that mistake, I was not certain, but I resolved to try. Rhea struggled again to break loose, to no avail. As she twisted in her leafy clothing, I caught the barest whiff of the freshness of the forest we had left behind. I stepped closer, planting my staff on the stones to help keep my balance on the slowly spinning floor.
Let her go. She has done nothing to harm you.
The king's eyes burned as the shadows danced over his features.
She would if she could, as would you.
At this, both of the Finchiron men nodded in agreement, while the Gulians in unison laid their hands on the hilts of their swords. The taller man glanced at me, his face tight with worry. He leaned toward the king and started to say something, but Stangmar waved him silent. Just then the Gulian from the dungeon marched up the stairs behind me. Although his face had been savagely scratched, he showed no sign of bleeding. In one of his hands, he held Trouble by the talons, so that the upside-down bird could only flap his wings and whistle angrily.
"Another friend, is it?" Stangmar's shadowy face turned to a pair of Gulians. "Go, see if there are any more."
Instantly, the two soldiers rushed past me and descended the stairwell. I then remembered that I had lost track of Shim. I could only hope that my small companion had found a secure place to hide. Frantically, I turned from Rhea, smothered in the arms of the warrior goblin, to Trouble, dangling helplessly in the grip of the Gulliant.
"Set them free," I shouted to the king. "Set them free, or you will regret it."
Stangmar's frown deepened.
"We are not accustomed to taking orders from a mere boy, especially when that boy also threatens our royal person."
Despite the continuous wobbling of the revolving castle, I stood as tall and steady as I could. Then Stangmar leaned forward in his throne. For an instant, the shadows departed from his face. With his square jaw and intense eyes, he looked even more handsome, while no less rigid than before.
"Nevertheless, your valor impresses us. For that reason, we shall be merciful."
Suddenly the shadows reappeared, moving frantically across his face, his chest, and the gold circlet on his brow.
"We know what we are doing," he growled, though it was not clear to whom. Regally, he waved to the goblin holding Rhea. "Set her free, we command you, but watch her closely."
The warrior goblin grimaced but obeyed. Roughly, he shoved Rhea onto the stone floor in front of the throne. Trouble, still hanging upside down, screeched wrathfully at the goblin, but he could do no more.
"What about the hawk?"
I demanded.
Stangmar leaned back in his throne. "The hawk remains where he is. We trust him as little as we trust you. Moreover, keeping him as he is will encourage you to cooperate."
My spine stiffened.
"I will never cooperate with you."
"Nor will I,"
declared Rhea, shaking her brown curls.
Trouble screeched again, making his own position clear. For the first time, Stangmar's frown eased slightly. "Oh, you shall cooperate. In fact, you already have. You have brought us something we have long desired. You have brought us the last treasure."
I winced, but said nothing. Shadows flickering over his face, Stangmar spread his arms to indicate the objects displayed on the walls.
"Here in this hall we have collected many articles of legendary power. Hanging on the wall above our royal throne is Deepakut, the sword with two edges, the black one that can slice into the soul, and the white one that can heal any wound. Over there is the famous flowering harp. That silver horn is the caller of dreams. Beside it you can see the plow that tills its own field. No more will these treasures or the others pose any risk to our sovereignty."
His face hardened as he pointed to an iron cauldron set by the opposite wall.
"We even have the cauldron of death."
At the mention of this object, the two men in red robes traded knowing glances. The taller one shook his head somberly.
"Yet the one treasure we have most wanted is the one not hanging from our walls."
Stangmar's voice boomed inside the hall, drowning out even the steady rumble of the spinning castle.
"It is the one you have brought us."
I knew that he would soon discover that I did not have the Galator. Emboldened by the certainty of death, I squared my shoulders.
"I would never bring anything that could help you."
The grim king observed me for a moment. You think not.
I know not. I once carried the Galator, but it is no longer with me. It lies beyond your grasp.
Stangmar, his face shadowed, eyed me coldly. It is not the Galator that we seek. I blinked.
You said you were seeking the last treasure.
We are indeed. But the last treasure is no mere item of jewelry. The king clasped the arms of his throne. The last treasure is my son. A wave of horror flowed through me.
Your son?
Stangmar nodded, though his face showed no joy. It is you I have been seeking, for you are my son.
Chapter 37. Deeper Cut. Dark shadows played across the king's features while his large hands squeezed the throne.
And now we must complete the promise we made before you fled with your mother.
Promise?
I asked, still reeling from Stangmar's revelation.
What promise?
Do you not remember? I looked morosely at the man who was my father.
I remember nothing.
That is fortunate. Stangmar frowned more deeply than before. The shadows wavered on his face, even as they spread slowly down both of his arms. The king clenched his fists, then pointed to me and issued his command. Throw him into the cauldron. In unison, the Gulians turned toward me. Trouble, still in the grasp of one of the Gulians, beat his wings and struggled to free himself. His enraged screeches echoed in the cavernous hall, rising above the rumbling of the spinning castle.
No!
Cried Rhea, jumping to her feet. Quick as a viper, she leaped at Stangmar, closing her hands around his neck. Before his guards could come to his aid, the king wrestled himself free and threw her back to the stone floor. She landed in a leafy heap at the boots of the warrior goblin. Rubbing the scratches on his neck, the wrathful king stood up. His entire body writhed in shadows. He barked at the goblin. Kill her first, then we shall deal with the boy.
Gladly,
rasped the goblin, his narrow eyes alight. He reached for the hilt of his sword. My heart pounded, my cheeks burned, rage surged through me, the same violent rage I had felt against Denatius. I must stop this from happening. I must use my powers. Then searing flames engulfed my mind, the stench of charred flesh, my own screams. I feared those powers no less than I feared the cauldron of death. The warrior goblin, grinning savagely, slowly lifted his sword. Its blade glinted in the torchlight. In the same instant, Rhea turned toward me, looking at me with sorrowful eyes.